Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it is Ladies with Gumption. We are back with episode 49, Blurred Lines from Smallville to Gotham, where we are going to discuss Caroline Dries, and who's the new showrunner for the Batwoman series that's coming up later next year. next year. So we're going to talk about that today. We, of course, are Ladies with Gumption. My name is Jessica, and I'm here with
May
and Tatiana.
And we recap DC TV in a flash. You can contact us, as always, on Twitter, at DCTVGumption. Send us an email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, which you've gotten both feedback on Twitter and through email today, so thank you guys for that. Or you can hit us up on Tumblr, because we also got a lot of asks. And our Tumblr is ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. So, speaking of that, we'll get into some feedback with Gumption. KJ, who is at Wingster55 on Twitter, sent us a couple of notes on our last podcast, where we talked about the kind of double standards between how characters of color are written and received versus their white counterparts. May has his tweets up. What kind of feedback did he give us?
So first he says it reminded him that he had argued with an Elicity fan that stated that Dinah should have had no issue with OTA and Felicity spying on her and them, which goes back to, you know, because OTA is primarily Oliver and Felicity, with Diggle as like the little sidekick, but everyone's like hating on the other team, who happens to be all people of color. And then right. He also mentions that we did not mention Sarah and Diggle's son, or how OTA is considered OFD, even though Diggle was there earlier and the Oliver Diggle relationship was more important in season one, but then kind of withered away.
Yeah, I feel like Sarah being baby Sarah and not like Sarah, but baby Sarah. And I feel like the whole switch from baby Sarah to baby John, you know, black kids are interchangeable.
Right. It was definitely disrespectful, but like not just the fact that they switched it, because they made that a plot point, at least, you know, that John was mad about that, but that they did that precisely because they didn't want to make Oliver's kid black.
Yes. And I think that would be my takeaway from it as well, because they had on Legends, I guess it was season one Legends. It was a Legends season that I did not watch.
Yes.
And they had that, you know, flash forward into the future where we met Connor, which I don't even know, like, if his name's going to be John Diggle, then why was he going off? He had, like, the name Connor Hawk, but it wasn't because he was actually Oliver's son. It's because, for whatever reason, they made him
John. He just thought that sounded cool.
Yeah, it sounded cool, I guess. And so to fix that plot hole, you know, Guggenheim used Barry's flashpoint to be like, oh, look, we changed their gender. And now baby Sarah is baby John. So that's how we get to the future. It's like, well, you know.
Yeah, and I also think that they changed it and you thought it was going to actually go somewhere, but throughout season six, which really focused on, you know, family and having a family and all of, at least Oliver's family. See, where John Diggle Jr. is not even important in this entire storyline because they forgot that Diggle had a son.
Yeah. Yep. So you don't even really get to see, like, the, you know, early stages of how John Diggle Jr. becomes Connor Hawk sometime later on in his lifetime. You just don't see him. He doesn't exist. Basically.
Yeah, they don't interact. It just, whatever.
So now we're upset. Thanks, KJ.
Yes, I respect that KJ's always keeping us in check.
Yes.
Making sure we remain humble, reminding us of all the things that we did not include.
Oh, and he also mentioned that we didn't include Linda, which I think somebody else also mentioned that we could have included Linda, which...
In our defense, we were originally only going to do from this season, and then we expanded at a later time, but...
See, guys, we're not awful. We're not that forgetful.
But if we were going to talk about Linda, I don't know. I feel like I would say, like, for the most part, she was treated relatively well. Like, in season one, it was unfortunate that they used her, you know, when she marries Wally, and instead Barry is dating her, and she's a little asshole to Iris because of girls just being that way. But I feel like that's something they would have written even if she was white, because they think girls are just that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then we actually got a friendship with her in season two before she was rudely sent away. But never to be seen again. But yeah, but again, I don't think that that's like that's happened to white girls too, aka Tracy, right? Like, so that's not, I don't think that was like.
Well, we did get another, this was an ask on Tumblr about Magan. And this person's like, you know, I agree with the discussion how her storyline suffered from a double standard when compared to white women, but I feel it's also important to note that she was a guard at the internment camps built by white Martians, the same that have been clearly paralleled with the Nazi concentration camps. She did end up breaking rank, so she's, you know, clearly a step up from Mon-El, who did not apologize for... Anyway, this man did feel a little bit uncomfortable that we were basically, you know, Magan isn't innocent, which, you know, that's fair because, mm-hmm. you know, it is in Magan's past. I think for me, what my ultimate gripe was is that mm-hmm. if Magan had been white, I feel like the narrative and characters, several people in her story would have gone above and beyond to exempt her from that, whereas yes. Magan was punishing herself and feeling guilty and trying to do the right thing, but she didn't get any kind of like sympathy from anyone or anything else, which I think that she would have gotten if she was a white character.
For sure. I mean, yeah, like, because once again, it follows the pattern of characters of color being, especially women of color, being the ones who are profiting from institutional disparity, right? Like we had with Roulette, like we had with Grace / Pestilence. I was like, which one is she? Yeah. Right? They think about it, they're like, yeah, I love preying on the weak, you know? And so Magan starts off like that, right? Somehow she's in the superior, whatever you want to call it, the race that considers themselves superior. But then right. now she's punished for it and punishing herself for it. So it still follows the same pattern.
Yeah. I think she punishes... Like, she is held accountable in the sense that she punishes herself, and the narrative holds that standard, but I think that she continues to be punished in a way that she wouldn't have if she was white. Like, if she was white, then she'd be Caitlyn, and everyone would be saying, oh, no, we love you, you know, right. you're not that wrong, kind of thing.
So. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And also, like... For Mon-El, at least, when they do the flashbacks when he left that girl behind when his planet was, like, being destroyed or whatever, it didn't come off as if it was a bad thing. You know, like, he had done something wrong, per se. Not as much as, like, Magan's backstory did. So he was kind of completely forgiven for anything he had done before we'd even really known what he'd done, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So thank you for bringing that up, because, yes, it does need to be acknowledged. We also got an email from Joe! She talked to us about a couple different things. I'm assuming it's a she, because it's J-O. But if it's not, I'm sorry. the first thing is about, like, Grant and the leaked suit and... You know, they're like, I know we pay attention to Grant because Rover invested fans, but he's, you know, he's not like, what's his face? Spider-Man, Tom Holland, or like, you know, he's so big, I don't even know his name.
Such a Marvel fan, Jess.
Yeah, like an A-list Hollywood celebrity. So it was just for Joe, it was kind of like, were people just waiting for him to have a fit or any white male celebrity to have a fit so they could, like, you know, come out with all of their, you know, anti-body shaming campaigns or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as our discussion on the last podcast, Joe also mentioned something that we did not discuss, apparently. Flash also has an issue with ignoring race, even with a racially diverse cast. So we don't really see anything specific about Cisco's Latino or Hispanic heritage. And the West are very rarely acknowledged as a Black / African American family. And this also applies to recurring and guest characters. So, you know, it comes out with those extreme examples of tone deafness, like what we got with Dominic being sold by Aminette and that kind of stuff. And then she wanted to hear our take on some of the recurring characters and villains of color for, I guess, The Flash that we kind of got into with Supergirl and Arrow. But, I mean, those shows are a lot wider than The Flash. Yep. That's why we didn't cover them.
For Flash, there was definitely... what's her face from season 4 in that Ralph-centered episode where he ended up being, like, the white savior and she was Native American and she was made to look bad just because she was actually stealing back her people's artifacts, which were stolen from her. So she was made to look like the villain and didn't really get much sympathy, whereas Ralph was the one who returned the items and made to look like a hero.
Yeah. I was so mad.
Yeah. I really Black wanted Bison. Me. Black Bison, that's right.
I really wanted Black Bison to win.
It's like beat his ass.
Yeah. Black Bison was definitely a case of like white savior, and the fact that they're trying to make Ralph the white savior was like the most insulting part of all, right? The worst white savior you could have. But yeah, and I don't know. It's interesting though, because like that's even proof that when your show is primarily dominated by white people behind the scenes, even having people of color write that episode doesn't change that much. Because, like, that was the episode was written by a black man and a Latino man, you know? And you would not know that based on the episode. You would not have thought that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We also got a Tumblr ask about Supergirl this time, comparing Brainy with Mon-El, like if we look at it the same way as we talked about some of the other characters, or like we talked about Mon-El and James, but they wanted to know what our take was on how Brainy is treated and written compared to Mon-El. And I think that Brainy will find out this season.
Yeah.
TBD. We have news that will, you know, makes me side eye a little bit how they're going to treat Brainy, but. We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
So, moving on into news, we have a lot of casting news. So, Troy James from America's Got Talent has been cast as Ragdoll. And Troy is a contortionist. And so, you know, this is going to be a very creepy episode, I feel like. Tati, do you have who Ragdoll is in the comics and what he does?
Also a contortionist. Basically, he can just sort of like make his body fit like any place or like any, you know, so it's a little bit like, it's kind of like Elastic Man. Goddamn, what is his name? Elongated Man. But he's also a hypnotist. So aside from being able to contort himself, he can also sort of convince you to do things.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That's gonna be really creepy. Like, Gotham had Mad Hatter, and that like was it made me stop watching Gotham for like a long time because it was just super super creepy with, you know, how he was like manipulating people, and then his incesty thing with his sister, which is gross. So I'm not. It's like he's gonna creep me out. I know, and since he's a ragdoll, I don't know if he's gonna be like, you know, clownish looking, and like that's just there's a whole lot of no.
Hopefully it's just the one episode.
Caitlin's dad also got casted this week. He'll be played by Kyle Secor, who was Lily's dad on Veronica Mars. Mm. So that's cool.
Yeah.
It is. Dude can play really, really arrogant really well. So
yeah.
Look out for that.
Nice.
I think it's going to be good that Caitlin's finally going to get, you know, some actual family backstory that presumably will stick this time around. So, that's good.
It's a crossover. It will feature Tyler, I think
it's Tyler Hoechlin.
Tyler Hoechlin as Superman. He's coming back. He'll be in all three episodes. And we finally get Lois Lane.
Woohoo!
Yes!
Journalist.
Party!
So, any fan casts for Lois?
Someone preferably of Middle Eastern descent, since Jenna Dewan is also of, I think her father is Lebanese or Lebanese.
Yeah,
his grandpa,
I think that would
cool. Yeah, so that would be cool if they kept Eastern. That going on. But
that's
if they
nice.
Want to make her also adopted, like that's fine too, and they could just cast another woman of color, you know. So something along those lines, I prefer that over like casting a white woman.
And please cast an actress that's over 30.
Yes.
Yeah, some of, like, the fan casts, I've seen even from journalists, and this, of course, is, like, white media, so, like, some of their hot takes are Lea Michele.
I was all so upset about that. I was like, you will not cast Lea Michele as Lois Lane. Get the fuck out of here. Lea Michele,
Paul Rudin. I'm like, no, I don't like these. So I hope that David Rappaport has, you know, more creativity than some of the fan casts that we've been seeing. And it'd be really nice if she was a woman of color. And also super duper nice if she, Kara, and Ihurst got to have some reporting time together, since you're going to have three journalists, you know, in one press. She's got to be coming to do something, so.
That's definitely, like, the lowest bar for me. Like, if they do not have Kara, Iris, and Lois interacting, talking about journalism together in the crossover, then they can just throw the whole thing away. I don't care.
And Clark can tag along, since he's technically also.
Yes, Clark and Jimmy can also be there. They just don't need to... They just don't need to involve themselves that much. But they can just hang out in the background.
With that said, though, do we think the crossover will largely take place on Supergirl's Earth?
It sounds like it now.
Yeah, I guess it depends on if Lois knows. Well, I mean, like, why would Clark drag Lois across the universe?
If she doesn't know.
They were interrupted on a date. I don't know.
I guess so, because we know that Batman exists on Supergirl's Earth, but then I'm just trying to figure out, how does Arrow introduce Batwoman if she's not on, you know, Earth One? I don't know. It's complicated. So
yeah, because the Flash is starting kicking off.
So the crossover dates have been revealed, and it all starts on December 9th. And the Flash is moving to Sunday, so it's switching places with Supergirl. So you have Flash on Sunday, Arrow in the middle, and Supergirl rounded out on Tuesday.
Yep.
Which is going to confuse a lot of people.
I mean, it's kind of weird, because I'm not sure why they needed to switch it specifically. Because, like, if it's supposed to be, like, I guess it's not. I guess they're not making it like a 3-hour movie this time around, right? The Flash episode will feel like a Flash episode. That's the only reason I can imagine we're switching it. Otherwise, why not just have the Supergirl episode first and make it whatever it's supposed to be, right? Because last year it didn't really matter.
I mean, one of the only reasons I can think of is that because the Flash will have their 100th episode before that, they can kind
of want to tie up the loose ends before they get into the crossover part.
Maybe the first 10 minutes.
Or maybe like the Flash kicks like the end of the 100th episode crossover.
Yeah, maybe.
Moving on, there are two Supergirl casts. One's a recast. Brett Spiner's role as Vice President in Supergirl is being recast and will now be played by Bruce Boxleitner.
Yep, those two dudes sound the same to me. I don't know.
I don't know who either of them are, so it doesn't matter.
That's something. And then Supergirl has also casted an unnecessary DEO agent named... played by Anthony Cock. I don't even know.
Konechny? I don't know. I mean, that's how it's spelled. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, but he is going to be a recurring DEO agent Jensen, who is enlisted by Alex Danvers. So this is what I was talking about earlier when I was like, Brainy's treatment, because he's like a cute white boy and he's blonde. So, you know. A new white man for people to ship Kara with instead of Brainy. And so I don't know if that's, you know, why else is he here? Why are you here, Agent Jensen?
Right? I mean, the only thing I can imagine is because, like, for some reason they think they need two DEO agents. And since John is not going to be in the DEO anymore, they're like, we need another one. Yeah. But
maybe he'll be another kind of version of Wynn.
Yeah, that's true. Although Brainy's supposed to be, like, Brainy's Wynn. Yeah, exactly. The only thing I would say is that since he's only recurring, that's a good sign that they're not, like, trying to give Clara a new OTP with him, but we'll see. We'll see. We'll be watching you.
Well, was Mon-El recurring at first?
No, Mon-El was a series regular.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the recurring part makes me feel better.
Oh, he's, like, another Supergirl rumored cast. Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
Yes. TV line, blind item.
Yeah. Do you have that pulled up?
Yes.
So Alex might be getting a new love interest who is a black woman, and May's going to tell us about that.
Yes, so there's a blind item from TV Line that suggests it's from a popular TV show, and it was one of the most contentious TV breakups in recent memory. So this will be, it's, you know, essentially kind of like a rebound. And it was a popular romance, and there will be a brand new love interest, and there could be a courtship. It says that the newcomer will fill a need that her predecessor could not, thus helping pave the way for a romantic connection. So, yeah, so a lot of people do think
I love this song.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and it'll be an interracial relationship stymied by the new character's own recent breakup. So, if this is Supergirl, which we think it is, this person will obviously want children, which Maggie did not.
Or have them. Yeah, the love interest will want children, or she has
a child. Yeah.
She's prepackaged. It's a prepackaged
meal. Which is what I wanted. I wanted that last season with Sam and Alex. So if I get it this season.
Yeah, and they'll probably, if the other person has also gone through a recent breakup, then her and, you know, Alex will have something to talk about and hopefully mend each other's hearts, and it'll be so cute. I'm already ready.
Yes. And then it's going to be Grey's Anatomy. Well, okay,
there's like two people who think it's Grey's Anatomy, but a lot of people think it's Supergirl.
Yeah, it's going to be Supergirl. It's going to be Supergirl.
And then the last casting news for Doom Patrol on the DC Universe. Brendan Fraser has been cast to play Robot Man. What do you think of that casting?
I'm really excited for Brendan to have his comeback.
Yeah.
Because
that's like the only reason.
Yeah, because he had like some trouble, you know, like after he came out with his own like sexual harassment story. So,
yeah,
so that's good for him.
He did great work back in the 90s. Like, I literally grew up on Brendan Fraser, so I'm excited that he's getting this, even though I'm not clear on Robot Man and Doom Patrol, but, you know, it's still exciting.
He's got everybody.
What was
Titans
that?
Titans must be so jealous.
Yeah, right?
They're getting all the great people. Really... Like, okay, we made Titans, but Doom Patrol is our show.
Yeah, clearly. This is my new show.
I love Doom Patrol. Moving along quickly into more controversial news, Ruby Rose, when she, you know, we talked about how she was cast to play Batwoman, and then she recently quit Twitter because, you know, people were not happy that she was cast to play Batwoman. They, you know, felt free to tell her that all over Twitter, all the time. So she quit. And as expected, you know, white media responded with, you know, indignity and outrage because that's what they do when you're white.
Yep.
I called that last time too. Yeah. Like, you know, watch. There's going to be like, you know, articles coming out in defense of Ruby Rose.
Yeah, it was like New York Times covered it and like a couple other big name.
Right. But like, and of course, like, not that it's good that people were harassing her, you know, or that she felt like she had to quit, but we do see the disparity. Although now it's, you know, thankfully, Kelly Marie Tran came out with her own statement, you know, and then that got a lot of press. But had to make her statement to get
right.
Okay, so, finally, into what we actually came here to talk about today. like I said in the beginning, Caroline Dries is the new showrunner for this Batwoman series, and so we're kind of, like, shaky on how we felt about this choice, and so we decided to go back to some of her earlier superhero work, and she wrote some episodes for Smallville. So we watched those episodes, there's 12 of them, to see, you know, what we think of her skills as far as, like, writing the superhero genre. So our criteria included for grading these episodes, and we're not going to go through each episode because 12 is way too many, so we're just, like, broad strokes. But our criteria for grading includes how she writes for female characters, how she writes for ships, how her episodes are structured, can she handle sensitive topics? And then finally, based on all of the above, what can she bring to Batwoman and what should she conveniently forget and never do again? And seeing as how I'm the only one that hasn't watched Smallville before and I'm seeing it for the first time in 2018, like, let me get all of my prerequisite Smallville as a series whole thoughts out of the way. Like, it's super white. And it was like one of those shows, because we were talking about in one of our earlier podcasts, is that you look back at all the stuff that you were really, you know, in your pre-woke days, and you look back at it now, you're like, wow, this is super white. I feel like all this is super white. And it just upsets me knowing on two fronts that Allison Mack played Chloe, because one, she was the whole cult situation, so she doesn't really seem like a good person. And then, I've heard this a couple times, the fact that Chloe was originally supposed to be played by a black woman, like the casting calls for a black woman, and Allison walked her happy ass in there, and just for the hell of it, and was chosen because she was so daring to try out for a black woman's part, you know, so that's, you know, sucks. White ass Lex Luthor and his white ass daddy. Like, I'm Michael Rosenbaum is probably a great guy, but I grew up on the DCAU and my Lex is black, and then, you know, it just goes back to the whole super small building that, like, super white. But out of the 12 episodes that we saw, I only saw two non-white people, and that was Cyborg and Rachel Davenport, who was played by Christina Milian. You know, well, but
Lana's not white.
Well, Lana, yeah. But do they really, like...
They never talk about it, but...
Yeah, that's not something they acknowledge.
Yeah. But having, like...
In this house, Lana is white.
In this house. Like, having said all of that, I think Erin Ashmore was, like, the perfect comic book version of Jimmy Olsen. So I thought his casting was really great. And my eyeball twitches every time Kara is pronounced Kara. Like, it just got on my nerves so much. And I kind of, like, I like Justin Hartley, and I feel like he's a great Oliver Queen, but I feel like a lot of Smallville things were a little campy, and if he had just had, like, an edgier like, a Stephen Amell Oliver backstory, but with Justin Hartley, like, I feel like he could have had his own, he could have been, like, the Arrow.
Yes.
In our Arrowverse now. So.
But he was just so damn charming. I was okay with the, like, the of the darkness in the background.
But he's grown and sexy and doing very well in This Is Us, so we're proud.
Yes, yes. Yeah. We don't need, he's doing better already in This Is Us than he would have been had he birthed the Arrowverse. Yes.
Right. So, we're going to move on. I'm going to hand the mic to Tati. He's going to take us through our trip down Smallville memory lane.
Although Jessica has already done a marvelous job of introducing the topic, I don't really have anything to reiterate, but I will tell y'all that in case you want to follow along or want to refresh your memory on the episodes that we are watching and that we are discussing, the ones that Caroline Dries wrote either the story or the teleplay or both for are episode 515, Cyborg, episode 521, Oracle, episode 611, Subterranean, 619, Nemesis, 705, Action, 709, Gemini, 712, Fracture, 717, Sleeper, 803, Toxic, 808, Bloodline, 815, Infamous, and 819, Stiletto. That is how much we care about y'all that we spent nearly 12 hours watching Smallville episodes so that then we could talk to you about how we think that in some way will connect to Batwoman. And clearly, we skip Vampire Diaries entirely because we are not going to hold that against anybody. Hopefully, that's a different genre that will not transfer to Batwoman.
And she was the showrunner for Vampire Diaries, right?
Once Julie Plec, I think, sort of stepped away from it or was dealing more with originals, etc.
Okay.
Yeah.
But she was, for sure, an EP of Vampire Diaries. Whereas, and it's something that you do have to consider, that Caroline Dries was merely a writer for Smallville, so she didn't have as much control. So what we're looking at is not so much the big story arcs, but how she incorporated her style and, like, you know, what you can assume is her perspective on things into the individual episodes. Right. And we're not going to go through every single individual episode and tell you what happened and blah, 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 because that would take 5 billion years. We're just going to give our general impressions based on the criteria. Starting with criteria one. How does Dries write her female characters? Ladies?
I mean, I think the best female character Caroline wrote for was Lois. Like, she didn't... Based on just these 12 episodes, she didn't seem to like Lana that much. But I think the show in general didn't seem to love Lana on her own individual terms. Except when writing her with the vendetta against Lex. And even then, she was written as if she finally became interesting only after experiencing trauma, And then when it came to Chloe, I did notice that Clark was usually mentioned in some way when it came to her. For example, Jimmy thinking Clark didn't like him because he's with Chloe and therefore jealous of him. And Chloe telling Clark that he can't tell Lois a secret because she'd pretty much sell him out. And that was a bit annoying. But it could be me being paranoid because there were some people who shipped Chloe and Clark. otherwise, Chloe was doing Chloe things, which was providing exposition and also keeping her own secrets a lot of the time. She was relegated to, like, best friend in the purest form. So a lot of her stuff always had to do with helping to keep Clark's secret, even if that meant throwing her own cousin under the bus and not believing her capable of handling it. So Chloe's kind of written, like, with the only girl mentality in Caroline's episode, and it showed when she'd comment on about other women, at least for me. And in the later seasons, when Lois became more prominent, she was really good at writing her at her job, giving her some agency, but she didn't have many scenes with Clark, so the romance section for Caroline was a little, it was missing a little bit. And Lois was usually written as smart, capable, and passionate about her job, which is what we expect for leading ladies. But as far as female friendships, they didn't really exist in her episodes. And I think for the most part, the show. There was like one time when Lois offered to listen to issues Lana was going through with Lex, but we never actually got to see that conversation happen. Otherwise, the women rarely interacted in her episodes, and there were even scenes where the ladies would switch off and only one of them would end up speaking with Clark. So building female friendships was clearly something that DCTV has always kind of struggled with.
I am like in a worse off position than both of you because I'm like jumping in and out of like storylines and arcs, and I never know what's going on. Like, if what I'm thinking or what I'm seeing is a show thing or a Caroline thing. And so I'm trying to like distinguish between, you know, trying to like be very specific on some kind of things. I think that overall in the episodes that the women, when they're written in their individual non-romantic storylines, it seems to be stronger, specifically for Lois and for Lana. Whenever they are, when she writes for them, that's not centered around like Clark, or it's like Lois or Lana driven, then those come off a lot stronger. I think she writes them better than she writes Chloe. Chloe seems like an afterthought sidekick for the most part. And then, but like the thing, I do agree with you about like the whole only girl syndrome, May, because like in the later seasons, and again, like I'm jumping in and out of like story arcs, but she's like with Jimmy, then she's not with Jimmy. But then she's got to marry Jimmy, but also, like, Oliver is really close to her, and then Davis is also really close to her, who's slash Doomsday, and so it's like, why is, like, she's in, and then she's, like, Clark's best friend, and so, like, she's in the center of this, like, male tornado, where all the men are close to Chloe.
A male storm.
Yeah, and what you also miss this just later on, that she gets with Oliver, so she also has a relationship with Oliver.
Yeah, I knew that. I knew that she somehow winds up with Oliver at the end. I'm like, how? How is this possible? Like, what is going on? The stuff that I did see from her in Chloe's parts in the episodes, it seems, you know, very much like that kind of sidekick role. So I don't kind of get it, you know, it with her in fandom, just from watching Caroline's episodes. But I do agree with you that, you know, Clark is, the whole Chloe Clark thing continued on with the whole, like, you know, Jimmy being jealous and all those little like comments that you're like, okay. I think that Lana's romantic storyline / love triangle with Lex and Clark were just kind of all over the place. But then again, like, I don't even know. I feel like it was a hot mess when people were watching the show, and it seems like a little bit of a really complicated situation just from, you know, pop jumping around the seasons. But I did like her dark side saga when she turned on the Luther family because of the whole fake pregnancy that forced her into a marriage with Lex, which, like, what kind of soap opera bullshit? Like, what is this? It was so weird. Like, why? I thought she was really interesting in it, though. I feel like it gave Lana a way to kind of sit in the driver's seat of her own story, so to speak. Which I think that was episode 619 or whatever, where there is like a bomb going off and like Lex was underground and, you know, Lana was trying to do her own thing and threatening Lionel. And then she had like another one where she was still kind of like had her vendetta against the Luthers. And she felt very like powerful in those moments. But then I don't know that if it is because of the writing or just because Kristen Kirk really lifted those scenes to give them some depth. Cause it really could have just looked like Lana looking crazy. And I agree with Mae that, you know, it's kind of unfortunate that I only saw that Lana because of a direct consequence of her experiencing trauma at the hands of the Luthers. So I don't really, you know, I don't think she felt as present or as like powerful outside of that. She wasn't like really written that way because either she was like really upset with the Luthers or she was being lied to by everybody else. So that's the only time that I felt her had like drive. Caroline's early episodes were really Lois light, but when she did write Lois, I agree that she seemed to play to Lois's journalistic strengths a lot whenever she did write her. And she also got like a Lois centered episode to kind of, you know, show Lois's strengths, and she played up to those. One major critique that I probably have, and I'll probably repeat later on, is that there seem to be a lot of stories in Caroline's episodes with women being emotionally manipulated and taken advantage of by men that they trust. So you've got Lana with Lex and Lionel and that whole, you know, whatever that was, that whole bullshit. you've got Rachel Davenport, who's in season 7, played by Christina Milian that I mentioned earlier, and she was an actress, and the person that was trying to kill her was the PA in the movie. So that was a whole fucked up fanboy episode. Like, you know, we're going to get to that. Kara. I hate that. Kara, when she lost her memories and wound up in Detroit somehow, and the diner boy that was supposed to be her friend kidnapped her, and then Lex took advantage of her amnesia as well later on in the episode. And then, I guess, to some extent, Lois and her editor, seeing as how, you know, he was her boss, first of all, and dating her, and he was also related to Lex, and he was also a clone. So there was a lot that was going on in like stories where women are being like emotionally manipulated, that it's just kind of like, I don't know.
Yep. You speak the truth. Well, I pretty much agree with a lot of what both of you ladies have said, especially about the women being manipulated by men they trust and, you know, put in these kinds of precarious situations, and whether that's something like, I guess what I'm going to say is that like, that was prevalent in almost every single one of her episodes, but that's also something Smallville did a lot. That and women being possessed by, like, other creatures, like their bodies being used for another purpose, like some kind of evil purpose. Like, that happened with Lois when she killed Davis/Doomsday, and I was like, and you know, in whatever episode, like, there's never going to be an episode, or there never was an episode where Lois dealt with the fact that she did that, even though it wasn't her, you know?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing is glossed over really easily, which was one of Smallville's big flaws. And what's interesting is that when I think about Smallville, like, I think back on it, I'm like, oh, there were so many women on that show, and they all affected Clark's life in so many ways, you know, and got to have their own lives outside of Clark, and I really liked how it was about them shaping him and not really him shaping them. But I didn't feel that way while watching these specific episodes. I was like, what? So, like, even though you had, like, 6 women on that show, she failed the Bechdel test, like, almost every single time. Because, like, even when 2 women spoke, it was about Clark. Or it was about Doomsday or whatever, you know? Some dude. Oliver, maybe. But, so I don't know. It was a little disappointing to go back. It definitely took off my rose-colored glasses about Smallville.
Nostalgia's a bitch.
Yep, exactly. I do agree with the other ladies, and even though it may be our bias, I do feel like Lois got the best treatment in terms of her independent story when it didn't involve men. And I think that that's partially because she didn't have a major story that involved a man in a romantic way. So, Caroline in particular, but the showrunners in general, didn't have a creepy destination with her. Like, for them, it was like an effort to include Lois. So when they did include her, she actually got something to do. Whereas both Lana and Chloe, I think, suffered from being too loved in the wrong way, right? Because, like, Chloe, it's like Chloe's got to be that special girl, like, the sidekick, the one who can be the be-all and end-all, solving all of Clark's problems to the point that she doesn't have her own life, you know, or her own desires or her own anything.
The one thing, and this is not a Caroline thing because it's, like, a show thing, but the one thing that, you know, at least Chloe's, like, her progression to super genius makes sense.
Yeah.
That stuff happened. Like, she didn't start out, like, being able to do, like, snap her fingers and open up firewalls.
They leveled her up. Yeah.
And it was part of those, like, a supernatural things. Like, oh, it's Brainiac. And when she did hack, sometimes she actually had to leave the place to go somewhere else to be able to do the things that she did.
that may be a Caroline thing, you know, that they actually show, she actually shows how Chloe gets things done. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, like, in a way that's, like, Lois, too, like, how she's getting things done on the journalist side of things. So that, you know, breaking down what the characters are doing is something that she can do. And then Lana's on the flip side, I feel like the writers, like, the showrunners were obsessed with Lana, and they also punished her for that, right? Like, and I think that Dries in particular, I don't know, I feel like she thought Lana was stupid. And we'll get into that. But for now, I'll just say that Lois gets to show her confidence while doing her job. And she's also, like, she's the source of a lot of humor, but she's not, like, the butt of the joke, mm-hmm. right? The show kind of laughs with her rather than laughing at her, I think, for the most part. The editor romance was not a good look, but I don't think the worst parts of it were in Caroline's episode. So at the very least, she sort of just kind of was like, I don't think she was very interested in Lois' romance. So she was like, oh, okay, whatever, moving on. Which is a good thing for that romance, because it sucked. Anyway, one thing I thought that was kind of interesting was that Lois got to, like, bring up life skills from her party girl days to try to, like, apply them to the situation. And at first, I'd get excited because I was like, oh, that's so cool that it's like, yeah, you know, life hack. But then it, like, didn't work because supernatural situation that she's in that she doesn't know about. So I was like, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, because on the one hand, you could say it's like she's trying to show that Lois is smart in her, you know, she's smart in her own way and she's got her own, like, she can handle herself, but then it doesn't work. So can she handle herself? I don't know. Like, what do you think? and the two times I'm thinking specifically are when she jimmies the lock, when she and Kara are trapped, and then also when she tries to cure Oliver's hangover that's not really a hangover. So I was like, but, like, for example, in that Oliver episode, she did a great job of taking care of Oliver after that. So it does show that she does have these skills that it doesn't harp on the way that it does with Chloe, but that she is competent and caring in her own way. A character that does get mocked and that it is funny, the show laughs at them, or at least Caroline laughs at them, is Lana. So, like, a lot of the scenes, like, for example, when she rightfully throws in Clark's face how much he lied to her, and then says she can't, like, that she can actually trust Lex because he would never do that. And then immediately the audience is reminded that Lex is, like, hardcore lying to her, right? And, like, faking a pregnancy and, like, doing evil things behind her back, like, literally in the very next scene. So it's like, LOL, Lana, that's hilarious that you think that. So, I don't know, it just feels like she's being punished for, like, not just trusting that Clark had a good reason to lie to her for 6 years, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, now she's done, but she's with someone even worse. Or, when she tells Clark that she feels closer to him than ever before, right? After they've had their little time apart, and now, you know, she's, like, so happy, like, she's, and he's like, I'm falling in love with you all over again. She's like, yeah, I feel like we've never been closer. And then again, literally the next second, it's like, LOL, it's Bizarro Clark. You're stupid, Lana. You feel close to him because it's not even fucking Clark, you dumbass. So I don't know, like, it's weird because the show clearly thought of them as the OTP, but the way that they're written, sometimes in these episodes, it's like, why would they be your OTP? Why would you do this to your OTP? That's what I want to know. And yes, I agree with you guys that she, like, ironically got more agency in her vengeance against Lex because she was previously robbed of all of it through the forced marriage, through the fake pregnancy and miscarriage. Mm-hmm. The fact that she married Lex to begin with to protect Clark, it just shows to what extent Smallville made women's, you know, lives subordinate to him. But those were not Caroline's fault. So I think it was nice that the way that she wrote Lana sort of taking back the night, so to speak, that goes in the plus column for her, you know? She was like, yes, you will get some vengeance. and so yeah, I feel like she seems like a Chloe stan, but in the way that like Caitlyn stans are stans. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like she doesn't get more personal development and growth, but it's more like she is the best plot device, right? She will solve all the problems, and she will, like, sad facts like poor Jimmy and creepy murderers like Davis will be obsessed with her. So, like, it was kind of scary, I think, to me, the degree to which Chloe was, like, a self-sacrificing automaton. And I think it's, again, I can't tell if it's, like, she had other characters bring it up. Like, it's actually dangerous how much of Chloe's life she gives up for Clark. Is that like Caroline saying, hey, this is a bad idea, but she can't stop it from happening because that's the story, you know? Because then Chloe will just be like, well, this is my choice. It's my right and it's my agency to just do nothing.
My body, my choice.
Exactly. So I'm like, oh, this is really weird. I don't know how I feel about this. Like, at one point, Oliver says, like, she's not living her life, she's living yours. And it's like, that's so accurate, but there's never any step that's taken for Chloe to get away from that, you know? Like, someone should put Chloe in Clark rehab, right? Like, 40 days, cold turkey, no Clark. But it doesn't happen.
The only way that she got away from him, at least for a while, was by, like, lying to him about Davis. Like, she would keep her distance, but because she was lying, not because she was, like, getting help or anything like that.
Right, right. And that was just, like, so that she could have her own little fake secret romance, but really he's a psycho killer. Sorry, Chloe. So, yeah, it's just, okay. This is awkward times. So Tess has sort of a similar situation to Chloe in that her character is based on, a single-minded devotion to Lex. But I would say that the brief glimpses that we get, of her in Caroline's episodes show her more treated, a little bit closer to Lois, I think. That she's allowed to stand on her own, and she's allowed to, like, sort of grow in her own way, mostly because she's not doing all that much on screen to begin with, right? So she is a little different every time that you see her. Same with Martha, that we barely saw her. And you can't blame her post-Jonathan story being all about Dinal, being all about Lionel on Dries. I was going to say Dries, Lionel. You see what I did. But, you know, we'll have to talk about Martha later, because the one episode when she was prominent was the best episode. I say that sarcastically. So, finally, Kara. Kara was depowered, kidnapped, trapped somewhere, lost somewhere, like, every single time we saw her. There's always something wrong. It was really, again, uncomfortable, because she's supposed to protect, she's the one supposed to protect Clark, and she even says that. And yet, he's the one constantly saving her. So, again, I don't know, like, maybe she didn't have a way around it, but she never wrote any moments of empowerment for Lana, for Kara whatsoever.
Yeah, I guess I didn't write it down because I didn't want to say Kara so many times. But I did, like, you know, jumping through these seasons, I'm like, okay, I see that she's in, like, the credits, and then you never really see. She's off somewhere. She has amnesia. She's stuck in the Phantom Zone. You know, all this, like, where is Supergirl? And I don't even think you ever really get to see that so much. And then when she finally does get out from the Phantom Zone, like, she's, you know, Warrior Princess by then, and then she comes back, and she's like, okay, gotta go.
Yep. So it's a little bit, you know, that's not a great one. So basically, Lois is her best one, and everyone else. So write all your women like Lois, and write none of them like anyone else. Thank you for that. Criteria number two is how she writes the ships in her episodes, and there are plenty of ships to choose from, and not many that we personally love, but nevertheless. Onward.
Again, like, I don't, I'm like flying blind, but from her episodes alone, I know that Chloe and Clark were a big thing. I don't get it. I didn't see it. I feel like there's more understated tension between Clark and Lex than I did Clark and Chloe. And it's like the whole, because a lot of, I think she was probably kind of obsessed. That was her straight white woman gay fantasy couple or something. There's a lot of, like, Clark and Lex tension. You are my only friend, Clark. Him entering Lex's mind to bond with baby mind Lex to prove that Lex is still good somewhere deep down, so Clark can still save him potentially. You know, straight white women should have loved this ship, and I feel like Clex walked so Clark could run the Chloe Clark thing, because I feel like it's the only reason why a thing. So she wrote, I think, and I feel like Clark and Lex was probably the one that she was the most interested in when she was writing her episodes, that relationship. I think the only, at the time that I wrote my notes, the only shippy episode that I liked so far was 619 with the Clark-Lana-Lex triangle, just because I think that was one of her better written episodes. But then later on in the season 8, when you get to finally Lois and Clark starting to come together, which I'll, how in the world are you 8 seasons in and the OTP, the final couple, is still kind of not together? But I guess we'll get to that in a minute.
Lois
but,
wasn't introduced until season 4.
Yeah, but it's yeah. In seasons later, like they were still in.
I know,
seasons,
yeah.
And Clark is still with Lana, or not with Lana, but wants to be with Lana. And I'm just like, well, I can understand how people could be like confused about what you're actually trying to do with your show. I liked the 619 episode with Clark, Lana, and Lex because everyone had something to do and there was something to mine from. So you've got Clark and Lex down in their whole, you know, I loved you, but you betrayed me kind of thing going on down there. You've got Lana who's on, like, you know, a vengeance streak and Lex can die down there. But wait, Clark's down there too? Now, shit, now I have to go save both of them. And so there's so much, like, going on, angsty kind of stuff. But that being said, I think it's, yeah, it is a little ridiculous that you're going into season seven, and you're still focused on Clana if the end game is supposed to be close. And then I think, you know, I liked that episode, but then there was another episode, the Mind episode, where she did the whole Clark watching Lana and Lex have sex, and that was like, why are you doing that?
That was messed up.
And I think that was, and again, I think that was because she was obsessed with Clark and Lex and not really so much with Lana. That had more to do with the two guys than it did really centering Lana in anything. And like Clark and Lois weren't really heavily featured, even though Lois came in season 4, they didn't really get a lot of scenes together in Caroline's episode, so there's not really much for me to say. And then once they did get together, I did like the only one I didn't get to see is episode 19, which probably would have been my favorite because of the episode description and the whole Clark telling Lois that she's
sad.
And so I would have liked that a lot, but the last one I got to see, I couldn't get any links for it, but the last one I got to see was 8:15, and I thought that was really, what was the one where they went to the Phantom Zone? See, they do a lot of things where they pull Clois together, and then they undo it by the end of the episode, so it's like, you know, she goes to the Phantom Zone, and she's clearly like, Clark, we're in an alien, we've been abducted. And he's like, no, you're not. Don't be crazy, Lois. It's like, why are you still lying to her? And then, like, he'll say that, you know, he'll finally come out, and then they undo it half the episode later. And so there's, like, but then again, I don't know if that's a Caroline thing because she didn't really like Clois, or if that's, like, a show thing because the show didn't like Clois. So.
It's a show thing because, like, Smallville was, like, 1:15 of Flash over and over and over again. Because there were like so many times that he would reveal his secret. The first time he revealed the secret to Lana, he had to reverse time because things happened. And then the same thing happened with Lois like 3 times before she finally, you know, found out.
Yeah, that's annoying. With respect to like the other ships, and from Caroline's episode, it's really only like Jimmy and Chloe. And, like, Jimmy's Clark obsession is obvious, you know, again, whether that is because Caroline wants to, like, throw in, look at Chloe and Clark, or if that was the showrunners or the CW saying, push this proto-Elicity pairing in the show 6-7 seasons down, let's, you know.
The only thing that I would say about why I think that it's also partially because she doesn't care for Chloe's is because they didn't, in her episodes, they didn't really get any, like, OTP lines. That even when you're not, you know, even when you don't have your ship yet, you get lines or moments where you're like, yes, you know? Yeah. And she did not come up with any, so.
Yeah. Kana definitely seems like the most mined relationship from a show perspective. Like, they beat that horse to death. And then, as much as the showrunners seem to love Quanna, they also loved undermining it and Lana. So, you know, I feel like that's a show thing. I would never expect half of my OTP to get married to the enemy of the hero, for example. So, like, Lana getting married to Lex and actually going through with, like, a pregnancy, even though it turned out to be fake, because they didn't want to go that far. But they also had her actually get married to him. So, it's, you know, why would you take your ship
and off? Saying I will always love someone else in the right. Sex dream sequence?
Mm-mm. Yeah. So, Ness, not great. Yeah, that's a pretty toxic thing. And Karen, I feel like that's the whole Clark watching a memory of Lex and Lana thing was a Caroline thing. And that's, I don't want ships to be written like that. I think she can leave that one in the Smallville past. So
on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. Let's not do that. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that her episodes weren't really ship-heavy, but even though they weren't, it was easy to see that each ship was built on lies, and more lies, and that always reared its ugly head whenever anyone wanted any honesty. Besides the lies, Lois and Clark's future relationship was, like, teased twice, maybe, in the episodes, but there wasn't much on that front because the show was still so focused on the relationship trip to nowhere that was Clark and Lana, or that ended up going nowhere. And Lana and Clark had moments in her episodes, but as a ship, there was more drama than there were genuinely happy moments even. And I feel like that was just the whole issue with their entire relationship. And the only part that I'd even call sweet between them was the fall from the building save in the, episode, I think season 7, the action episode. But like Jess already mentioned, they were like obsessed with Lana, but also treated her really poorly and made her look like she was in the wrong for asking for honesty, or sad for believing that Lex wouldn't lie to her. And then I feel like Caroline and probably the rest of the writers felt that a relationship between them was only interesting if there was something going on in the drama department, whether it was like a misunderstanding, lies, 7 seasons worth of pining, and love triangles and toxicity. And then this is even apparent with Chloe and Jimmy, who were cute, and which I learned on Twitter is an unpopular opinion. But there were still lies between them two for a little while, and then still they were the only couple in her episodes though that talked things out and were put in specific situations to do so, like in the ship, in the elevator scene when both of them thought they were going to die from a bomb and they had to talk it out, and then they got back together afterwards. So like that didn't happen with any other ship in her episodes. But I also noticed in the ship baiting with Chloe, like, even though it was one-sided and slight, Jimmy thinking Clark was jealous proved the point that she valued Chloe enough as desirable to the male lead, even though Clark was clearly not interested in Chloe in that way. And then this happened twice, and Chloe's lines about Lois sometimes made me raise my eyebrows. Like, I think it was something along the lines of her worrying Lois was going to leave Clark behind at some point because of her work. And I'm like, this is a concern, like, after he stood her up once. So it was there, and it proves, like, she might have been interested if the showrunners had potentially opened that door for them.
But, like, yeah.
Yeah, but in general, she did seem, like, to avoid writing Lois and Clark together in any scenes until after Lana was completely gone. And to me, she was more interested in Lex and Clark's friendship than she was in any other relationship, like Jess said.
So do you think Lana has, like, only girl syndrome in her head?
I think she might, just based on, like, the way that Chloe was treated. But I feel like that's just the way Chloe was treated by a lot of the writers, too. So I hope it's not just Caroline, but just the fact that there was a couple of, like, ship-baiting stuff in there. And her repeating, like, I'm the best friend in several episodes, to me, was just like, odd.
Yeah. I said I wasn't going to bring Vampire Diaries into it, but I am going to, because I feel like you can see that with the jump from Elena being the only girl to Caroline being the only girl. Mm-hmm. So,
interesting.
That's all. Anyway, are you done? Sorry.
Yes, I am.
Okay. As for my thoughts on ships, I agree that this was not a great, these episodes were not a great showcase for Smallville ships. Although I did think the last two were good for Clovis in terms of Erica and Tom's chemistry, more so than the writing itself. But what stood out to me the most was that, you know, the show didn't want to let go of Klonna, and they are getting, like, insane OTP lines, like, you're the center of Clark's universe, and I've only seen love like that once in my life, and then the director yelled cut in season 7 or whatever, you know? So it's like, all right, we get it. It's the OTP to end all OTPs until it's ended. But like you guys already said, they drag Klonna through the mud consistently because of that ship. And first she had to swallow, like, ridiculous lies, right? So we saw that even in her first episode, that cyborg episode, where it's like, why are we seeing this dude, you know, she knows about this dude's powers literally 2 seconds after meeting him, and she's helping him with his power situation, and she's reuniting him with his girlfriend, and she's perfectly, there's nothing wrong with this. She's, you know, she comes out of it okay, and yet after that you don't think, I guess I should tell her the truth. Like, what are you not connecting? I don't understand. And that goes on for, like, 6 seasons, which is ridiculous to me. And then once she does know the truth, it just, I don't know, I guess it just feels like there was never a reason to keep it from her in the first place, mm-hmm. because she's just fine after she knows the truth. It actually gets better. And yet they repeat that same thing with Lois. And she even has some similar lines, like Caroline wrote some similar lines to what Klonna had already gone through before, right? Like, oh, she can't know because she's special. Like, that has ever made sense. So it's just like, okay, I guess.
Which would be ridiculous if you think about the fact that Lois knew about Oliver. It's not like she was blabbing his secret around town or something.
She's perfectly fine knowing about Oliver.
Yeah, so, like, what's the deal?
It doesn't make sense. There's no logic to it. So I'm not saying that it's her fault. Like, it's obviously not her fault that there's no logic to this, but she definitely did not make any attempt to add logic to the situation, is what I'm saying. No attempts were made. Anyway, the other thing, you know, was the baiting moments for Chloe and Clark, and they were really minor because they're always from Chloe's side, mm-hmm. and Clark has no interest whatsoever, but I definitely felt like, oh, she ships that, and she would very easily go off script in that direction if she was allowed to, which, again, bring you a Vampire Diary, but that revolving door of ships existed for a reason, because they go to the ship when the spirit moves them, so that is something that they can just leave at the door for Batwoman. Let's not do that. I don't have an issue with temporary ships, but I do have an issue with revolving ships in a main cast of characters.
Yeah, there's, because that's just not realistic. Like, Gossip Girl, everybody's, like, having sex with everybody at some point, and no one has an issue with it.
Yeah, that's not a thing. So, anyway, and on the other hand, it could also be, like, it's less of, maybe less, like, she specifically wanted Clark to happen, like, Chloe Clark to happen, and more that, like, she's one of the people who likes their hero or heroine to be universally desired, because it reminds me of Christina Milian's character, who shows up and is suddenly like, I would like to hook up with this hot, sexy man right. to save me. And she has to be, like, reminded that Klonna is right there. So she might just like Clark being the most desired, and Chloe is there and available but to
it,
desire him.
I think it's funny because it's like Clark has the, you know, Clark and Barry for me are, like, very similar in that they're very single woman oriented in a lot of ways, so it's like they always try to throw women at them. It's just like, obviously he's not interested.
Yes. And like you, May, I thought Chloe and Jimmy were cute, and I had to learn from Twitter that was unacceptable.
And I was like, wait, what? You know, they had their moments. It was cute.
Yeah, and I also think that's when Chloe was most allowed to, like, live a life for herself, mm-hmm. you know, except for the moments when they inserted Jimmy's jealousy over Clark, which weakened the ship. And, of course, like you already mentioned, the lies that she's consistently telling to him, which also weakens the ship, and which I guess proves that Chloe and Clark are more alike than they think, because they constantly think that they should lie to people to protect them, and no one has ever been protected by a lie. So, once they overcome that hurdle of the lies, which I thought was nice, like, I really did like the bomb episode. I think that was, I've forgotten the name already. We'll figure it out later. But I really liked the bomb episode in which they had to sit there and talk it out, you know, and get back together in that way. But then they stuck Davis in there, and that was super uncomfortable. Like, I don't understand what the whole Davis storyline, like, I don't get what they were going for, but it was nasty.
I was watching with my sister, and she's like, why is he obsessed with her?
There is no explanation for why he's obsessed. You know what, actually? Even that's a little bit of Chloe Clark baiting. Because he thought that he was being called back because of her, but it's just her proximity to Clark that was calling him back. Mm-hmm. So even that's a little bit. I see you. I see what's happening here. But anyway, I will give a shout out to Lois and Oliver, though, because like I said, I thought that Lois was written really well in the episode where Oliver was unconscious and going through his island memories, because her speech to him when he's unconscious and she's saying, like, she let him go, she broke up with him so that he could save the world. And so if he dies now, you know, not saving the world, then there was no point and she should never have broken up with him. I thought that was a really beautiful speech, and it really, I mean, it moved me. It was one of her more vulnerable moments, and it also was one of the few times, I think, that a ship was not undermined, and it was rather like, you know, it emphasized what those characters meant to each other, even though that ship, in the grand scheme of things, didn't mean much to Smallville. So I really liked that. And then there is the actual ship that ends other ships, Lois. Like you guys already said, she did not, before she had to, no hints for Chloe's for drop whatsoever. I think, like, at most, there's, like, one time where she's like, well, when I date someone, I'm not going to work with him. And you're like, oh, lol, because you will date Clark and work with him. I get it.
There's a lot of foreshadowing.
Yeah. But aside from that, there was, like, they interacted as little as they possibly could. But I do think that she did, like, a relatively, like, a decent job of writing for them in season 8 once you actually had to put them together. She had to work within some very stupid confines, like the fact that Clark felt it was impossible to tell her secret. But her attempts, like I said before, her attempts at, like, OTP lines were kind of weak sauce. Like, definitely, there was not oomph behind them. You didn't really feel that.
I think the only thing that she said was, like, when they were stuck in the Phantom Zone and Lois was, like, freaking out and, like, Clark said something like, you know, Lois and Clark are going to make it out or something like that. He said Lois and Clark. And that if you were like, oh, I know that, you know, this is
yes.
But it was, you know, very subtle. Like,
yes.
Very subtle.
Yeah, I already mentioned the moment where he says he can't tell her because she's special and infamous. And that was so stupid. I was just like, what does that mean? Like, what is special about her that you can't tell her? Because you already told Lana, and I know she's not more special than Lana. So, like, this is nonsense.
Didn't he also stand her up in that episode?
Yeah, he stood her up. But then at the end, he stands her up in Infamous. You're right. He stood her up in Infamous. And then in Stiletto, it was where he unstands her up, doesn't he? He forgot to pick her from the airport because she's not important. And that was also, she really isn't important to him. Like, this is sad. And then at the end, he remembers
her past. Yeah, that was kind of sad, like, right before because he uses the Legion ring to undo his, like, coming out to the world. And when he's doing it, and she's like, Lois is, you know, so you're going to go back and I'm going to forget. And it's, like, if you think about, compare this to Flashpoint 301, with Barry and Iris, and she's, like, worried that, you know, I'm not going to remember any of this, I'm not going to be able to find you again, and Barry's like, you know, we will always be, you know, find each other thing. But
Clark was like, yeah, you're not going to remember.
I'm not going to remember this, like, I'm not going to feel special to you anymore, because you told Lana and Chloe, like, a long time ago, and she was even, like, trying to, like, help him, because she's going to tell him about Chloe's voicemail, and he, like, puts a ring on, and then she can't even finish her sentence.
Yep.
And he's off. Yeah.
The disrespect.
Yeah, that was, yeah, definitely not a parallel. Not a parallel.
Not a parallel.
Anti-parallel. But yeah, and then, like, somehow that episode proved to him that he can't tell Lana his Lois' secret, which makes no sense, because all she did was help him. And it proved to him that he can't be with Lois, which makes even less sense, because he was with Lana just fine. Like, whatever. I hate it. I hate it. It was stupid. It didn't make sense. No explanations were provided. Even though I said I love this episode, I love their interactions, I hated what it meant in the grand scheme of things. Okay,
like,
there we go.
Lois and Clark really came into fruition in seasons 9 and 10. Seasons 9 and 10 are the only important seasons.
The only useful seasons of Smallville. But anyway. So, I will say, though, that if I wasn't thinking about Lana, the interactions between Lois and Clark in those last two episodes, I could have made me forget that he was in love with Lana, like, 2 weeks ago. So that's why I say I think that she did do a decent job of writing them in those episodes themselves, even though I feel like, you know, they did not lead to happy things in my heart. All right. Point three. The third criteria is the structure of her episodes and how her plots unfold.
Plot holes. And this is probably like where I probably could have the most objective and not looking at the other seasons, because it is just basically how her episodes are structured. There's so many plot holes, and because I've never watched the show before, I don't know how many of those are like overarching plot holes or just, you know, her plot holes, but like those episodes alone, if I look at them within their own little bubble, it seems like she has plot holes specific to her episode, her writing. And I know, like, the show is quote-unquote old, so, like, you have TV writing cliches that were new and exciting and, oh my god, worthy back then, that are kind of, like, outdated and kind of corny now. But all that aside, looking at it, I think her episodes lack a lot of creativity for me. She got what should have been really, like, plenty of really huge, exciting storylines that, like, you know, those huge comic booky storylines. So she got Cyborg. She got a General Zod story. She got two General Zod stories. So she had one introducing him, and she had one with Doomsday. She got an immigration episode, which is something. And, you know, like, and she's got a couple of episodes where she got to include Brainiac. So these should have been, like, really huge, exciting, you know, big stories of the seasons. But they didn't really have a lot of depth and creativity to fill those stories out. And so because she didn't have, like, a lot of imagination to put together something that was exciting, you get these plot holes or deus ex machinas that are just like, oh, this happened because this conveniently is also happening kind of thing. And it just comes out, like, half-baked. So, for example, with Cyborg should have been a huge deal because of his comic background and the fact that Lee Thompson Young played Cyborg, and he was a huge deal at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And it could have been a launching point for, I don't even know if Cyborg recurred after that or came back to the show.
He did,
but yeah. It could have, he did or he didn't?
He did.
Okay. But I feel like it should have been like a launching point for the character, but the story just kind of fell flat. And then you don't even really, I don't know. I guess it was supposed to be like a origin point for him, but it just kind of felt flat and lackluster. And I feel like a lot of her episodes made me feel like that. Like, I was like, the main part of the story was already over, and then look at the clock and there's still like 10, 20 minutes left in this episode. I'm like, oh, damn. So it just felt like really long. Probably her best bottle episodes, again, 619, Nemesis, because I think she does a really good pressure cooker situation. So 619 was a pressure cooker with the bombs and the tunnels that nobody but Lex knew about. So Lex was somewhere that no one else knew where he was. He put in an obstacle for Clark because he couldn't blast his way through the tunnels because there's kryptonite. So now he's weak. Lex is weak. There's bombs everywhere. It's fixing to go off and no one knows where he is. And then Lana's like threatening to kill Lionel. And so there's all this like pressure situation going on. And then you've got 709, which I think is called Gemini, and that's the other bomb between Jimmy and Chloe. That was the other bomb episode. So bombs are her forte, apparently. This time, like, this episode was centered around Lois having to race against the clock to save Chloe from a bomb. And I think there was another one. The other one that I liked, Bloodline, was season 808, and that was with Clark and Lois when they get put into the Phantom Zone. And so that's another kind of like pressure cooker situation. And you have one of the Feyora escapes the Phantom Zone and she like possesses Lois, and like you get Doomsday kicking off in that whole episode. So those are like those pressure cooker type of episodes, I feel like, were the best ones that she's written. But I think she also borrows a lot from media and like big movies and plot lines that are going on at the time. So there's like the obvious Misery plot line from 619. I think it's 619.
Yes, I think so.
Where Lionel is like kidnapped in a field. He wakes up like alone in a cabin. I don't think it was 619, but I can't remember which one it was.
I think it was season 7.
Yeah, I think it was in season 7. But Lionel is, he's been, like, hurt, and he's in a cabin, and there's this, like, crazy lady that's pretending that she's, like, trying to, you know, help him, but she doesn't want to call anybody, and he can never leave, and so it's like, well, this is misery. So there's a lot that she pulled from that, and then the 717 sleeper with Jimmy and Chloe, which I think was probably their best episode of hers, when they're kind of, like, spying on each other and trying to outwit each other, but, you know, clearly that's, like, a Mr. and Mrs. Smith thing going on. So, you know, that's not really her story, because someone already wrote that story and made a lot of money off that story. And it's just, like, yeah, I feel like a lot of episodes that she wrote kind of ended in, like, 20, 30 minutes into the episode. It, you know, the climax is resolved, but the episode just keeps going, and I don't understand, like, why is there so much time left in this episode where nothing going on?
I didn't think of it that way, but when I was watching, I remember feeling like, why is there more? So you said it exactly right. Like, that's what it was. The last section of every episode just felt like a different episode. It's just something like, oh, this is still happening.
Oh, and I didn't say this. The fucked up fanboy episode Action in 705. Not only were there plot holes, it just didn't make a lot of sense, and it was gross, and there's nothing to tell the audience that she knows that this is gross and toxic behavior. Because, like, who decides? And I'm sure there are fanboys that are, because there's, like, fanboys that are, like, stabbing comics with knives, so, you know. And she had a, like, a, well, I'll get to that in the sensitive area, so I'll save that for later.
Next week.
There's next more person. Venting. Okay. For me, like, the episodes were normal or, like, mediocre, you know? Like, they weren't super memorable, nor were they very engaging, because I found myself distracted in several parts. Like, I'd look away or, like, pick up my phone. I feel like she did employ A and B plots, though, really well, but the episodes which were best for me was when she wasn't writing Clark as the main, if that makes sense. Like, whenever the focus was more on Oliver, like in the episode where he was poisoned, or in Stiletto when Lois pretended to be a superhero for a story, those were when her episodes made it more, for me, they were more engaging to watch. And probably because it was because these characters had more charisma than other cast members probably really helped. And I agree about creating tension. Like, for me, one of the best episodes with tons of tension and lots of emotional impact was Fracture. Even though we knew neither Lex or Clark would actually die, the whole mind thing is one of my weaknesses in storytelling. So she really knows how to build to that, even if the aftermath isn't as great as the buildup. And I agree with Jess that Caroline got a lot of important episodes, but didn't do them enough justice because the structure of her storytelling wasn't as strong as it could have been. So, like, in that same episode, Lana basically asks Clark to tell her the truth if they're going to be able to move forward, because we'd seen the buildup of Cyborg and his love for Catherine, but instead of a full conversation, we got a shot of Lana walking away. So that's more, could be, like, more of an editing issue, but it just didn't feel right within the episodes. I feel like that part was just cut off. And like a lot of other episodes, the contained storylines don't have to do with the overall plot of the season. We're sometimes incomplete in the actual episode.
Yes. So as someone who watched half the show, this is actually, some of these episodes was my first time watching them because they didn't have Lois in them. And I only watched Smallville episodes with Lois in them.
Am I the only one that watched the full 10 seasons and then, like,
I think you are the only one that watched the full 10
seasons. And then Jessica didn't watch any, so we're, like, levels.
Exactly. Different levels. So, as the middle level, I will say that I did find these episodes underwhelming. Because, like I had previously said, like, I really loved what I saw of Smallville. And then I watched these episodes and I was like, most of these were not the episodes I loved, clearly. My favorites were the last two. Because of the Lois parts. Like, you know, it was because of Lois and because of the close moments that he got in them. But outside of that, I agree that her Cyborg episode was a letdown, and that it's kind of, I guess it's like she doesn't necessarily come up with, like, new angles from which to attack a storyline, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it's a, like we already said, she is good at the bottle episodes. But when it's just, like, a plot that you have to, like introducing a new character, she does, like, that standard, like, Grey's Anatomy, like, or, you know, whatever, like, episodic thing where, like, the first scene is going to be introducing you to that character and, like, telling you a little about their lives. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be gone by the end of the episode. So do you really get invested or not? You know, like, I didn't get fully invested in any of those characters that were introduced, like Cyborg or like Tyler Posey. Or even, I'm trying to think of what other ones had, like, introductions of episodes, but either way, it doesn't matter. Like, point is that, like, whenever they did that kind of plot where it's like, oh, look at this thing, and then I was like, okay, well, whatever, that's fine. I don't really care. But she is good at creating tension, upping the stakes, which is why Fracture and Gemini worked as well as they did, because, I don't know, I actually, like, felt a palpable fear that some harm is going to befall these characters, even though instinctively I know they're going to be fine, but, like, I was actually like, oh, no, how will they get out of this? So that was good. And also it's Phantom Zone 1. Even though I think that Kara was kind of a deus ex machina in that. Like, she showed up and she's like, well, Jor-El or Zor-El or one of the elves gave me an out, so don't you worry about that. I just haven't been out because I decided to die here. So I was like, okay, this was unnecessary. But outside of that, she's good at developing tension. Even Subterranean, which was the Tyler Posey episode, was creepy. Like, I was concerned about the, like, earth swallowing demon thing. And while I knew that Farmer Guy was evil, I didn't necessarily realize that Farmer Guy was the earth swallowing demon thing, you know? So, spoilers, I guess.
And plot holes, because, like, how did he, you know, just pre-MAGA, I guess, like, you know, killing immigrants and making other slaves so that they work for my farm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, but, but it was creepy, so there's that.
Talk about.
Yeah, right? And while I said Infamous was one of my favorites, I think that that's where you see, like, escalation falls short, right? Like, we didn't get much of Clark being on top of the world. It was like he walked outside and two people were like, you're still amazing. And then suddenly they're like, okay, you're not amazing anymore. Like, it didn't feel real. Like, when Jess was watching it, she was like, he's dreaming, right? It's a dream. Because it feels like a dream. It doesn't feel like a real situation that's happening.
No, so, it was stuff over the top and, like, campy and, like, hey. You know, like, this when in Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, and he's like, oh, yeah. I'm
like, yes. Yes, it was like that. But like I previously said, I like how she shows the steps that the characters take to get where they want to go. Like, even like Lana planning her vendetta against Lex, and like the reveal of her being behind the misery plot. Like, we get to see those steps, and that's interesting and that's well done. But sometimes I feel like it's a little bit lax on motivations. Like, for example, a couple times when Lois just, like, callously breaks journalism ethics and there's not really any journalism consequences for that. Outside of, like, Jimmy one time being like, what are journalism ethics? It's no one's like, Lois, you should really try to be a journalist who cares about the way that you get your stories. Like, I love Sletto, but the fact that she was interviewing herself, which, you know what, is also something that Kara does on Smallville. Kara does on Supergirl. So clearly this is a carrying over in the world of DC TV, and it should not continue. Don't do this. Show them actually caring about the way that they do their job. Okay, another thing that I think that she did do well, and that I think the show structure in general did well, but it worked in her episode specifically, mm-hmm. is that she rotates different stories. So, like, we have, like, A plots and B plots that I think worked out well. So that when you are confused or bored by one storyline, then you do get the scene of the others. It's just that they could end stronger so that the last 10 minutes of the episode don't feel like they're unnecessary. All right. So, criteria number 4. How did she handle sensitive topics?
Not well.
This makes it sound like we hate Smallville.
Like, the immigration episode that we mentioned was just straight up awful. From, like, Tyler Posey and his struggle Spanish, like, oh my god. Like, the whole, like, rest of the plot, you know, the only thing that was good about it was Clark, you know, standing up to Martha and being like, I'm an immigrant, legal immigrant, and you took me in, because Martha was ready mm-hmm. to, like, call immigration, call the president, call whoever it is to get this Mexican kid out of her house. Clark. And so I was like, yeah. And, you know, the whole, like, creep factor of the, you know, white farmer and his indentured servants working the farm. None of them could speak English, and they had this, like, situation with Clark trying to, like, communicate or whatever, and it came off, like, I don't know. It was not great. It was and then you don't really even get, like, a resolution. Like, the whole episode was about immigration, but I'm not even sure if they resolved the whole issue of these kids and immigrants just being used for slave labor. Like, did anyone help them, or are they still okay? Like, you know. So that was an issue. And then the other episode that really, like, kind of pissed me off was the love letter to toxic white boy fandom called Action. Yeah, and the whole idea that, you know, fanboys are so crazy. And it wasn't even, like, fanboys are, like, so crazy that she was supposed to die, and so they're going to kill, like, in the comics, like, the character dies. So I'm going to kill this actual live woman who has done nothing to me other than play a role because she's supposed to die, and I can't separate fiction from reality. But we're not going to make that a point of the episode, really. We're just going to use it for him to be a villain somehow. And then, like, the thing is, like, she even had an opportunity to go beyond her reasoning was faulty, because the actress playing the girlfriend was Christina Milian, and I'm pretty sure I didn't really get to see, like, a close-up of the panel of Warrior Angel comic book to see what race the girlfriend was, but I think it would have been, like, a much more resonance to the story if the reason that this comic fanboy was upset was because they raced the Warrior Angel's girlfriend. But instead it's because she died and then she didn't die in the movie, which was kind of, like, it was lame, to be honest. And I was like, if they had said that it was because she was raced, been like, oh, this is like The Flash. But no. And then, like I said, like, they never really, he was a toxic fanboy, but they never really resolved, like, there wasn't, like, a point that I feel like Caroline was trying to make in that he was such a delusional person, because I think at the end, like, Lex right. even goes to visit him and, you know, give him all of these comics, rare comics, and so it's kind of like they were bonding in that moment, and it just ended very weird to me.
Yeah, it was like saying, oh, you're right, like, this should have been done that way.
This should have been done that way, and it should not have been done that way. And I feel like it's really toxic that it's just like, you know, she died in the comic, therefore this, like, random woman should die in real life. And he didn't even go, when he finds out that Clark is an actual superhero, then he goes, like, one step further. I'm like, I'm going to kill two women because I need this guy to be, like, a hero. And it's just, and then they use that to further the whole the hero must be alone kind of trope. And I feel like that was a point which makes it worse. So it doesn't really admonish a fandom toxicity. It kind of, like, is an ode to toxicity. It is used more for Clark's man pain and getting Lana to potentially give up Clark for the greater good. And so those are two of the big ones that I had an issue with. And if I remember another one, then I'll jump back in, but next.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny because, like, I read the Action episode as initially as, like, commentary on toxic fandoms and white fanboy tears regarding comic book accuracy and misogyny. But that's because I was looking at it that way. And my mind, I did expect it to go that route. But the acknowledgement never really happened on screen. And then I also zoned out a bit in the second half because I was just like, oh, this is not what I was expecting. It could have been great commentary on comic book fandom in general and, like, misogyny and, you know, fridging women and all of that. But it ended up being more like a cute thing, like, oh, it happened and you're my hero kind of way, rather than a more in-depth analysis and look at problems still plaguing fandoms. And like, as Jess already pointed out, Smallville was a really white show, so to expect them to tackle racism in any capacity was setting ourselves up for disappointment. In terms of the immigration episode, was pretty bad too. Like, if it intended to show quote-unquote both sides, it failed miserably because Martha just ended up looking like a hypocrite since Clark was also an illegal immigrant. But somehow that's different because he looks white. And like, Martha and Jonathan forged his papers and he's not even technically a U.S. citizen or originally from this planet even. So that whole argument just missed the mark and sounded dumb coming from Martha specifically. Like, this was also an episode that took something fairly serious and turned it into something far too simple before throwing it away completely. And then Martha comes around, but suddenly Tyler Posey, the only one she wants to help, like, she's a senator. So she could have done much more than she did. And she had the power to do a lot more than she did. So, no. Caroline Dries does not have a strong ability in dealing with more sensitive topics. At least not the ones that parallel real life issues. And that's that.
Ouch. Yeah, the long story short is not that well. As I previously mentioned, the glossing over of journalism ethics, like they're irrelevant, didn't sit well with me. But the more glaring moment was, of course, Subterranean. And I liked Clark protecting Tyler Posey. And I don't remember his character's name. I think it was Javier, but I'm going to call him Tyler Posey. And I liked that he made the direct parallel between himself and his own immigration status and Tyler Posey's. But I thought it was weird that they presented Martha as just following the law when literally she could, you know, work to change the law. And that's, like, sort of what she does at the end. But only because she got called out, you know. Yeah. Silently.
For that was the episode with the most diversity.
Yes. So yeah, like, I was like ready to like throw Martha away in that episode. I was watching, like, her Trump supporting ass trying to call ICE on Tyler Posey is not acceptable. And then she even said, oh, well, he was different from you, right? And I like that Clark called her out on it, but the show didn't like pursue it further. Like, I think that something that woman should do and that more shows should do is engage with that, right? Even if you have a character, like, it's not wrong for Martha to be that in terms of on the show, but what would help is if you have Clark sort of really question her about it, call her out on, like, isn't that racism, isn't that xenophobia, isn't that, you know, like, even at the end when she said something like, well, when you're dealing with extraordinary people, that, you know, you have to make exceptions or whatever, and it's like, No, you should be making exceptions for mediocre people, too. You know, you should help everyone. You don't just help exceptional people.
Mediocre lives matter.
Exactly. Like, what is this that you have to be, like, because you're different, you have to be extraordinary to be, you know, to be helped or to be accepted? Like, that's not the message that should be conveyed. That's some, like, you know, not like other girls bullshit. Yeah. And so, and I don't think it's, like, you know, like, I'm sure that that was meant to be heartwarming, but there's just always take it a step further, basically, is what I'm saying. Investigate that kind of dialogue when you are writing something that's meant to resonate with real-life issues.
Like, you're supposed to make your audience, like, ask themselves questions about these topics if you're going
to
touch on them.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. And I'm sure that Batwoman will plan to do so, because I'm sure that Kate, being a lesbian, will play a role in the storyline, and they're going to want to have, you know, some pushback there on LGBT rights. So they have to work on really setting, you know, setting the boundaries for what, you know, what message they want to convey. Yeah. Anyway, Warrior Angel episode, or Angel Warrior, whatever his name was, the action episode. Again, it was dealing with fandom misogyny and toxicity, but the message didn't go all the way. Like, at first, like Jessica, I was like, oh, that's so cool. Christina Milian was like the first black woman leading lady in a superhero movie. Who knew? But they didn't bring it up. It was not addressed. It was, and of course, this is a Smallville at large issue, since we already discussed that they ignored Lana's race. But she could have, like, you know, there's nothing that would have stopped her from sneaking in that line, because it would have been true.
She tried, like, the way that he tried to kill her wasn't even originally, like, the way that she died in the comic book. So he's just trying to kill her, period.
Yep. He was not trying for comic book accuracy.
No.
Yeah. But I feel like the at the end of the episode, it sort of, like, brought up that heroes need to be alone thing again. And it's, again, it was, like, I don't know, it felt like Lana maybe agreed, or like Clark agreed, you know, like there was a moment where it was like, why did we come to this conclusion? This is not the conclusion that we should have come to. But it was weirder to me that the misogynist / attempted murderer was then shown protecting Clark from Lex. You know, like Lex is trying to find out Clark's identity from him, and then he's like still protecting Clark, and it's supposed to be like a yeah, he's loyal moment. But like, no. Like, I didn't need that moment. I didn't need to be like, yes, crazy man who hates women is gonna protect Clark. Also, like, I don't know. I just feel like they could have framed it more like, you know, like, first off, this woman died in issue 5 of the comic book series, okay? Issue 5. So, like, that's how little that whatever comic that was cares about women. So, the comic book industry hates women, and that's why she died. And this man also hates women, so he wants it to stay that way. But they never actually, you know, went there, which I feel like they should have. And again, it's not like, you know, I can't just be, like, totally angry for, like, the thing that's not there. Because, like, I think it was, like, a fun episode, but in terms of actually dealing with serious issues, it just wasn't there. On the other hand, I did think that Lex's abusive childhood was dealt with, interestingly, in, I think that was Fracture. Was it Fracture?
Yes.
Whatever episode where he was in his mind, yeah. I thought that it was, like, a nice way of sort of humanizing Lex, but also, like, really showing us how your childhood affects your adulthood, right? And so, like, and it didn't make, like, Clark suddenly, like, want to be on Lex's side or, like, help Lex or whatever. You know, it didn't excuse him, but it did explain where things came from. And it also puts, like, you know, Lionel trying to help Clark in the present, or like, you know, winning over Martha or whatever, all that stuff that Lionel's been doing, you know, it doesn't change how he raised his own son and how he treated his own wife, mm-hmm. you know? So I do think that that's something like darker character backstories can be well handled by her, and Batwoman will have many of those. So moving on to our final point, which is less of like criteria on which we are judging the episodes and more just speculation on what we think Caroline Dries should bring to Batwoman from what she's previously written and what she should just let go.
Well, it's been a while since Smallville through the Vampire Diaries verse to Batwoman. So it's possible that she has evolved in some areas, that she's carried through some of her stronger points. I think that the thing, again, based off of the structure of how she writes, the thing that I would be most concerned about for Batwoman as a series is where the arcs and the season plot points, the big bads, those, like, overarching things. So I guess it just depends, because she's not writing, so she's a showrunner. Well, she could write a couple episodes, but I think it just depends on the writing team and how much creativity that they put into that, because I feel like there could be some major slumps in the season if they're not really tight on what the whole plot, overarching plot, is supposed to look
right.
like. She's the showrunner, so she's got to have like a really big hand in shaping what this series is supposed to look like. I do think that some of her strengths, those pressure cooker episodes, will lend really well into the Batwoman series. So I think that, you know, there will be some good episodes based off of that. She gets to control the ships, more or less, being the showrunner. So hopefully she can, you know, if the whole issue of her not writing certain ships in Smallville because she didn't like them, then she can, you know, write the ships that she wants to write, and then we'll have really good writing for that perspective. But I think, it, you know, with the whole only girl kind of vibe that we get from her, it is, you know, her main character is the heroine, so it's the whole, like, revolving door kind of situation, or is this going to be, like, the hero that can't have also a love life or something like that? So it could go either way on that one. The sensitive topics, I feel like there's a weakness that it might get a little bit white feminism territory, just because of the way that maybe it won't be as bad as like Supergirl, but I think there's a tendency to go into like white feminist territory. So we'll have to see. And again, I don't really know based off of like Vampire, there's nothing really for me to compare it to. But those would be the things that I would look out for. And then she should stay away from any sensitive topics that are people that can actually like write them. So it's probably like my main points. Bullet points for Caroline Dries.
Yeah, I mean, based on like all the criteria, I think there's some potential. And firstly, because Smallville was a long time ago, she's probably grown as a writer. She's had some experience showrunning too. So she could bring some new ideas to the table. And I hope that with Batwoman, we do feel the stakes, which she's been really good at, and that they're high, but that the resolution is also solid. And I agree with what Tati will say about having A and B plots. And I think that's something Smallville really excelled at, and they didn't stick to one location like a lot of the DC TV shows tend to do now. So I really hope that that happens for Batwoman and for all the shows, because, you know, we need to see the city and we need to have different plots going on in episodes. So that's part of the structure that I do like. So if Caroline can keep that up overall, then that would be great. And in terms of ships, I feel like there might be some ship baiting involved, but I hope that the pilot starts off with a strong, like, primary couple, or at least, like, a couple that we see would end up together. That won't take 10 seasons to get to, like Smallville did. And I also hope that they don't have, like, they can have placeholder ships for a while, but it doesn't prolong the time it takes for the main couple to get together. Because I feel like there could be a tendency to bring in a lot of people just to avoid, you know, bringing the main couple together for like 5-6 seasons, maybe.
I feel like with Batwoman that it's even more like a sensitive issue, because if they do bring in Renee Montoya and she's like a woman of color and she's, you know, she does not pass the paper bag test, then there could be a tendency, because I know like people get really like nervous around like Vampire Diaries and how they treated Bonnie. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's more of a Julie Plec thing than a Caroline Dries thing, but I feel like if Caroline does not like the ship, then you just don't see it based off of her episodes. And so if she really likes the dynamic between, I'm going to say Renee and Kate, then I think we'll be good, even if there's other ships coming in. But if like one of those other ships catches her eye more than Renee, then I think that could become a little bit problematic.
Yeah. I agree. But outside of ships, I think that since, like, Gotham has a tendency towards the darker stuff, and I mean Gotham as a city, not the show, that's Caroline's primary base, so we might be looking at another Arrow-type drama show, but hopefully with way more women. And I think that she can write three-dimensional villains, like she did with Lex, so she can bring that to the table. And she really seemed to like writing for Lex, so that can be exciting in terms of like bringing on a villain that will be someone, you know, Batwoman can face off with, but that also has like their own backstory and stuff going on. And finally, I agree with Jess, she should avoid sensitive topics, but hopefully if they do tackle them, she'll have like an inclusive writer's room to help her do that.
I definitely agree about an inclusive writer's room. I think that that's going to be super important, because there's going to be a lot of issues that they're going to need different perspectives on. But I do hope that the practice of A and B plots carries forward, because I always think it's nice to catch up with the other characters when the protagonist is not around. So I also hope that the ratio of women to men from the later seasons of Smallville carries forward. I think that, you know, just makes sense to me. It's Batwoman, right? It's not Batman. And I hope that Gotham is as much of a character in Batwoman as Smallville and Metropolis both are in the show, because I do think that the episodes that we saw had a nice amount of interaction between, like, Clark and the people. And you know, bringing in other characters from the world, you know, that you get to know a little bit, that feel somehow, you know, unique to Smallville or to Metropolis. I hope that there's one OTP in mind for Batwoman. And I hope that we stick to it without years of shipbaiting something else. And like I previously said, I don't have any problem against temporary ships. I don't have a problem with guest stars. And you know, I'm not one of those people that gets angry every time the protagonist dates someone who is not the main person, because you know that happens, right? That's just storytelling. But I don't want prolonged pining from someone who doesn't stand a chance. So let's not do that. No Chloe's. Already said, diverse writer's room, handle issues with care. We know that Dries herself is a lesbian, so I hope that that means that she's able... Yes. Well, now you know. She is a lesbian, so I hope that Kate's sexuality will be handled with respect, and that, you know, we will have diversity in many forms in the writer's room. And that if and when Renee Montoya shows up, I hope that they acknowledge her ethnicity and make it part of the story. And since we know that's not Dries' strong suit, let's have some Latino writers in there that can do that. One thing that I will say is that, because clearly they love the secret identity thing, and I think that this is the one of the few instances where it could actually be interesting and good to have keeping the Batwoman's identity a secret from Renee. Like, Renee is a cop, Kate is a vigilante, so if they get romantic tension introduced and you have to keep it a secret because that's literally, like, she'll arrest you, right, if she knows that you're a Batwoman, then Renee can meet Kate as Batwoman through her work first, so that that takes precedence over, like, their lifelong friendship, and now she's lying to her every episode, you know? So I think that's one way to keep the tension going and to make the secret actually necessary. At most, it can be like they know each other, but they, you know, they have some history together from whenever, but they've drifted apart since, and this is the first time meeting again after however many years. Because that introduced, you know, and not in the Arrow way, please. Don't.
Or not in the failed Wonder Woman pilot way.
Yes, not that way. No one's married. No one cheated on the other person with their sister. Like, not like that, please. For the love of God. But anyway, because I think that we do, I think it would be nice to get a real two-person love triangle trope. Just not in a situation where the lie is overshadows the relationship. Because when you've got two people that are supposed to be such good friends, who are supposed to, you know, like, literally best friends, or literally live together in West Allen and or Close's case, and yet they're being lied to consistently for no damn reason, that's not cool. Anyway, I have no idea who the big bad of Batwoman's going to be, but this is another instance where I think that following Smallville would help and not hinder, in the sense of, like, having it be a character that has a huge impact on Kate's life already, right? This is where, because that's toxic, right? Having someone that you're really close to that's lying to you all the time should create a toxic and enemy-style relationship. So that's where you want to have someone who's like Kate's sister, Red Alice, right? That could be the big bad. Not identical twin, please, unless Ruby has actually proven herself as an actress. Fraternal twin is fine. Or Tahani, a.k.a. the Knife, who it's like, there's like a weird love triangle with Sophia, like Kate, Sophia, and this girl Tahani, and then Tahani's evil. So something like that. Of course, Tahani is a woman of color, so hopefully she will not be the only one around, because then she would just be the bad guy. So anyway, I don't think that they should drag it out the way they did Smallville. Like, it doesn't need to take six seasons for whoever the big man is to go full evil. I think that, like, you know, one season of establishing that friendship but also driving the wedge between them so that the turn happens at the end of season one should be fine. And, you know, then they don't have to always be in your face doing evil things and not getting caught by Batwoman. They can come and go in the situation. And that concludes my thoughts on that one.
Yay. And that concludes our podcast.
Yay! So, yes. We are done now. We will be back probably next week. We have no idea what we're going to talk about, but I'm sure it will be awesome. So, please let us know what you think about our Smallville thoughts and what you loved about Smallville, because clearly we've not rewatched.
Like, what do you think about Caroline Dries? Because I'm sure some of you have, like, seen more of her stuff than clearly we have, so.
Right. Yeah, if you've watched Vampire Diaries, feel free to pitch in with what you think would come from Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, because I don't know, I know people think that Julie Plec did a lot of self-inserts as far as, like, who she wanted to be the main love interest on her show, and I don't know if, like, Caroline is a self-insert kind of person or not, and if that carries over into Batwoman and who. And it's like, again, because you said that Caroline is a lesbian also, so is she going to be another AJK, like, writing herself into, you know, Kate Kane, and that affects certain things in the show? Is that something we should be worried about, or, you know, not?
Yeah. And if you were a fan of Melrose Place, the remake with Katie Cassidy that lasted a season, she was a producer on that, so feel free to let us know about that, because I didn't see that one either. Yeah. All right, that's that on that. please send us the feedback at DCTVGumption on Twitter, ladieswgumption @gmail.com, or ladieswgumption on Tumblr. Good night and good luck.
Bye.
Bye.